This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 21st of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Culture is brought to you in association with the Spanish Tourist Office. Hello and welcome to the 67th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're well into the swing of the new year now. Our resolutions for a change, my friends, we've mostly resolutely stuck like glue to, and we're well in the mood to provide you a real aural treat. We hope, anyway, in the form of this edition of Culture. Here's what we got. Eurosonic sounds like an electronics discount store on the Tottenham Court Road, but it's not. It's actually a huge, yet discerning, music industry event held in Groningen in the Netherlands, the first of the year where talent spotters spot and bands play. BBC Radio 1's new music guru, Hugh Stevens, will be here to rustle about in his bag of promo CDs.
There is a large conference part to it. They pride themselves on a really stellar lineup every year. They touch on interactive things, on the music business.
And on a beautifully crisp and chilly day last week, Katie and I visited London's always unusual, normally wonderful art space, The Wapping Project, to investigate their upcoming immersive film piece.
Your own imagination starts to fill the space, and you have to trust that. You know, if you are judicious about the way you select objects and things, then your viewer, your participant, does the rest of the work.
We'll also head to Beijing to hear from the man in charge of a pretty groovy reboot of one of China's major art spaces, the Ulen Centre. Plus, we'll hear what to expect from this year's Art Stage Singapore. We'll visit the first ever retrospective of the life and works of Martin Scorsese in Berlin, and we'll get a minute of sound from the very, very end of the Florida Keys. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. So to kick things off in the studio this week, I'm joined by new music guru and host on the UK's leading pop music radio station, BBC Radio 1, Hugh Stevens. Hugh is fresh off the ferry from Groningen in the Netherlands, where he's been at the first music industry showcase of the year, which is called Eurosonic. And he's going to share some of the breakout acts that have caught his ear this year. Without further delay, Hugh Stevens, welcome to Culture on Monocle 24.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to do the niceties and bits and bobs in a minute, but first of all, there was one favourite track, maybe not a favourite track, but a sort of an earworm that you wanted to share with us first. What's the first song you're going to play for us?
It's by an artist called Son, S-O-H-N, and it was one of the most blogged about tracks of last year. He played his first ever gig at Eurosonic, and this is The Wheel.
I died a week ago. There's nothing left. It's caught on video. Very last breath.
And that was The Wheel by Son, BBC Radio 1's Hugh Stevens' choice, his first choice from Eurosonic in Groningen in the Netherlands, from which he has just returned fresh off the ferry to speak to us on Culture on Monocle 24. Hugh, lots of loops in that song. A beautiful thing.
It is beautiful. It emerged part of last year, and it was one of the most, as I said, blogged about tracks of 2012. So there's a lot of excitement about his first ever gig at the Eurosonic Festival. It's kind of the perfect place for him to play, really, because he's an international artist.
You should set up what Eurosonic is.
Oh, yeah.
I think we said in the introduction it sounds a little bit like a discount electronics store on the Tottenham Court Road, but it's not that.
It is.
It has an august history. Yeah. It's maybe for people it's a strange place, Groningen in the Netherlands. What's the town like? What's the vibe during the festival?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's a big university town, so there's a lot of young students there. Everyone owns a bicycle. Hardly any of them locked
up. Classic Holland.
Oh, it's beautiful. You know, when I first got there, yeah, it was totally stereotypical and beautiful. Always snowing pretty much when we go as well for the festival, the first week of January.
I see you came today with your snow boots on.
I did. Still got them on. Yeah. So it's a 2-hour train ride from Amsterdam. And yeah, the festival's been going for 27 years now. It started just as a Dutch music festival, kind of showcasing the Dutch music scene. So that was called Noorderslag. So the Noorderslag part the festival still happens on the Saturday. Wednesday, Thursday and Friday is all European, and it grows a little every year, like all good festivals. I think they tweak and change something every year. So there's a big festivals award ceremony on the Wednesday night hosted by Jules Holland,
right,
where it's the European Borders Breakers Awards, where a lot of different festivals, and artists from all across Europe are nominated for various awards. So it's a great festival. It's a good way, and it's all indoors, we should point out. It's not in fields.
So you don't have to wear your fur hat as well as your snow boots.
No, luckily all right. It's all in smoky venues.
Nice. Yeah. Good old fashioned smoky venues.
Yeah.
The Dutch stuff. What's the sort of geographical spread or the spread in terms of nations? Because we hear so much British music on British radio, likewise in America and on Japanese radio. It's very much kind of home turf stuff. Mm. Do you hear a lot of new stuff from Europe here? And is that the kind of point of the festival?
You do at Eurosonic, yeah. That's what I really like about it. I mean, I'm there for a short amount of time, so I try and go and see the European bands, not from the UK, that I might have heard one or two songs from in the last 6 months, say. And to be fair to Iceland and Sweden and Norway, the Scandinavian countries sell their music in the UK really well. There's a monthly night that happens at the Lexington in London called Zsa Zsa Zsa. Yeah, or maybe it's Ya Ya Ya. And they bring over the best artists to play there. So I knew about some of them already. But yeah, I do try and see European bands that I haven't seen before.
And you mentioned some of those Nordic nations, always been so good at marketing their stuff.
Mm.
Obviously, amazing ear for a tune. There seems to be a natural sense of Scandinavian melody that seems to sort of overarch all their output up there.
Mm.
But the marketing of it's really important as well. Is that something that's part of Eurosonic? It'd be nice to know if it's a music conference, whether it's a pure festival.
Yeah, no, there is a large conference part to it. They pride themselves on a really like stellar lineup every year. They touch on interactive things, on the music business. There was a keynote question and answer session with Martin Mills, who's the head of the Beggars Group, 4AD, Matador Records, Rough Trade. You know, Adele obviously was on everyone and has been on the music industry's lips for so long because she was such a massive success. So he spoke, and he never really does question and answer sessions. So it's conference by day, and then at night it's a mix of local music fans and mostly really music industry people from across Europe. There's a lot of festival bookers who go and try and either snap bands up to join their, you know, to join agents' rosters or to snap them up for their festivals in the summer. So a lot of the bands who play at January then play a lot of great festivals in the summer months.
So there's quite a lot at stake for a band hoping to make it this year. It's a good place to kind of pitch a tent and find a space on a stage, right?
Definitely, yeah. I think Robert, who books all the bands, he comes over to Brighton every May for the Great Escape Festival. Yeah. And, you know, he's got contact all across the European countries. So he is very proactive in quality bands and getting a really good lineup for Eurosonic every year.
And are there any trends you've spotted this year? We'd heard Sewn, The Wheel. That was a wonderful track at the top of our chat. That sounded like a little bit like something that could have come from Canada on 4AD maybe last year. Are we seeing a return of bands, or are we sort of heading more deeper into electro territory this year? Was there a trend at Eurosonic?
Well, people are saying that you know in the UK that guitar music will come back, and there were some guitar bands. Palmer Violets had a good gig, for example. From artists I hadn't seen before, I guess dreamy, synthy pop was kind of popular. We heard Son. It was his first gig. I think he was the highlight. He'll be having a busy summer. And he's still unsigned as well, a London musician living in Vienna. And then I saw a few Danish artists as well. I was obsessed with The Killing, so I made sure I saw the Danish bands from Copenhagen, like Indians, who are signed to 4AD. Yep. And that was mesmerising. I think Indians will do very well.
Unlock the door.
And Mo was an artist as well who I enjoyed. Mo is another Danish artist who is signed to the Chess Club label over here in the UK. A little bit like Licky Lee, maybe glitchier. So a female solo star playing with a small band who I think, again, will have a busy summer thanks to her Eurosonic gigs.
Hey, yo, yo. All the time I just want to let go and go.
One of the other great bands I saw was from the Netherlands itself, and they had a great reaction. It's kind of psyche, slightly proggy, called Jacko Gardner. And I think, like all festivals, if there's a local band playing as well, and they're really good too, then everyone gets really excited. So it was nice to see them play.
And also, I should ask you off the back of that, whether all these acts sing in English. We always think that the Dutch speak better English than the English, and the Swedish speak better English than the English, maybe. But is it still an important thing, and the spread of acts that you saw at Eurosonic? Do most people sing in what, in the sort of lingua franca of pop and rock music?
I'll be honest, they do. Most of the artists who especially want to gig and do things in other countries like the UK do sing in English. And I was asked during the festival, you know, if it's important for European bands to sing. And personally, being a first language Welsh speaker, I always like it when another artist sings in a language which isn't English and is good, you know. I mean, Psy with Gangnam Style, who'd have thought that would have been so big all over the world, and it's sung in Korean, you know. I mean, Sigur Rós is another great example of a band who sing in Icelandic, but also sing in a made-up language as well. So I don't think that language is...
People just basically spot the difference between the two.
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell either way. The music's amazing. But a lot of them do sing in English, and some of them choose to sing in two languages, some just in their native tongue.
Yeah, sometimes you just need a chorus, don't you? Gangnam Style, you maybe just need a chorus or like something, a shout along.
Just throw in Hey Sexy Lady and you've got a big hit.
That's Hugh Stevens' top, just throwing Sexy Lady. All right, Hugh, well, thank you so much for coming in and leading us by the hand through the streets of Groningen and Eurosonic Music Festival. For the time being, thank you very much, Hugh Stevens from BBC Radio 1. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. In a moment, we'll be off to an immersive film meets art meets photography exhibition here in London, but first to China. Because last week was full of firsts for Beijing. Pollution hit an all-time high, and the city's Ulan Centre for Contemporary Art launched On Off, the most comprehensive survey to date of artists born after the death of Mao in 1976 up through 1989, coincidentally the year of the Tiananmen Square protests. Wafting through the city's thick shroud of smog was our pal Marissa Matsuria-Katz, who sat down with the director of the centre, Phil Tinari, to talk about the 50 artists selected for the survey and how an era typified by reforms and globalization shaped their practice.
What this show offers is really a portrait of the first generation in China to grow up in an atmosphere of constantly improving social conditions, of a rising, more confident China, but also amidst a very intense set of tensions. The title of the show actually comes from the interface of a VPN, a virtual private network, which are these software apparatus that we use in China to get over the Great Firewall. And the most popular of these softwares manifests itself on your screen as a little toggle switch. And when you're on, you're able to get beyond and to see outside. And when you're off, you're sort of fully inside the Chinese online space. And our curators, Sun Dongdong and Bao Dong, who are two Chinese art critics and art impresarios of this generation, believe that this was a great metaphor for basically their reality, the world in which they'd grown up, where you could very easily but very definitively and absolutely switch back and forth between the Chinese and the international, between socialism and capitalism, between your generational sensibility and that of your parents or your family, and increasingly in the context of the art scene, between a sort of market-driven gallery system and a more experimental grassroots kind of scene. I was very adamant about the fact that I wanted the two curators to be Chinese. I wanted to remove the dynamic of a foreigner picking the artist as much as possible. I've, of course, lived here for around 10 years, and I'm very integrated into the scene, but nonetheless. And so Sun Dongdong and Bao Dong began in early 2012 taking trips around China, basically to every major concentration of artists in the Pearl River Delta, in the Yangtze River Delta, in Sichuan, up in northeast China, in Wuhan. And they visited over 200 artists. The list they came up with in the end is actually bigger than they expected when they began their research. But we felt just big enough to offer a sense of the vast range of positions and perspectives that you see among artists of this generation.
The show takes place at the UCCA, which is the Ulen Center for Contemporary Art. Why is it special that it's being hosted here versus any other space in Beijing?
The UCCA opened in November of 2007, and when that happened, this was suddenly the first truly international contemporary art museum to open in China. Since then, there have been many new museums and many expansions of state museums, but we remain true to this founding spirit of being really a museum that's not governed by politics and not governed by a profit motive. We perform for the city of Beijing the function that a museum of contemporary art would in most other cities. And it's really just a function of the fact that this is a very special political situation, that this responsibility falls onto the shoulders of a private institution rather than a public one. We're able to do a show like this because we're not actually part of the huge state cultural system. And there's a difference between what can and cannot happen and what the state institutions hope will happen. So simply by virtue of being independent, we're technically actually registered as a for-profit company because that's how one exists bureaucratically as a museum in China with a foreign background. We can do things that we do because we don't have someone in our organization issuing ideological guidelines, let's say. And I think this is something people sometimes get wrong about China. It's not as if, you know, Big Brother is pervasive and looking to shut things down at every moment. It's much more about not putting your colleagues or people, you know, from the relevant organs into bad positions.
Tanari offers to take me for a walk through the center's hangar-like halls while pointing out some of the exhibit's most captivating pieces.
So this is actually one of my favorite pieces in the exhibition. It's by a young artist from Wuhan named Li Liao. And what he did was sort of turn his body into an artwork. He took a job at Foxconn, a company that most people probably know as the biggest assembler of iPods and iPads with facilities throughout China. And he actually worked at this job on the assembly line, living in the worker dorms, like these people we hear about in the news all the time, until he had put together the wages to buy an iPad mini. So essentially throwing into light the relation between production and consumption, which is such a huge theme in this society. And in the piece, he actually displays this iPad mini. It's laser engraved on the back with his worker number, and it shows images of his time as a Foxconn employee alongside his uniform and other his contract and other documents of his stint as a worker. So this is a pretty enjoyable piece by an artist called Xin Yunpeng, and it's a mechanical bull, a mechanical inflatable bull in a sort of a moonwalk style cushion here that the audience can actually mount and ride. The problem is it's on a timer, so as soon as one has gotten on the bull and put on the cowboy hat, it then starts to deflate and you sort of fall back onto this cushion. I don't know. Is it a metaphor for progress and decline or cycles? I mean, maybe. It's also a great piece for the lobby.
I met up with Fang Lu, one of the artists featured in the On-Off show, who is also the co-founder of the nonprofit Beijing Art Space Video Bureau. While walking around the exhibition, I asked about her practice and what are some of the issues confronting young artists in China today.
I do think artists have to keep really sober whatever situation that they are in. There are a lot of commerce that generated with the type of Chinese identity, and I think it's still a lot of this is still going on, and where it really create very easy type of interpretation for artwork and art practice. Some people will have the type of expectation that they would expect from the earlier generation, where the type of political gesture, it's something very apparent in the artwork. And I think in a way it's different for this generation because there are a lot of things are made with more personal experience, and there are a lot of ideas that were perhaps more ambiguous. So many of the artists in the show were creating interesting work in that sense, that I think that's one good thing that I did see in the show like this.
That was artist Fang Liu talking there to Marissa Matsuria-Katz. And we'll be exploring Asian art again a little later on in the show when we find out about the aims for this year's Art Stage Singapore, which kicks off this week. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Get your coat on, and we're stepping inside into the coldest and most atmospheric cinema this side of Siberia.
A front row seat in a Roman amphitheatre for Merida's Theatre Festival. Rubbing shoulders with the stars at the San Sebastian Film Festival. Spain's performing arts are a visual feast. Dive into Spanish culture. Visit Spain.info.
This is Culture on Monocle 24. Now, to a Europe full of spies, men in trilbies bearing suitcases with false bottoms, and beautiful girls tossing aside their trench coats to reveal ball gowns and danger beneath. Actually, we didn't fly to Vienna or Venice for this next piece, but went on the overground to Wapping, East London, to the converted power station known as the Wapping Project, where Jules Wright has a longish history now of cooking up wonderful theatrical art shows. Ever surprising, always essential viewing. This time, Jules and Thomas Zanon Larcher have put together Passage, an immersive film project that pretends it's an abandoned cinema and presents moving and still images and a haunting soundtrack to take viewers, maybe we should call them participants, on a spyish tour through the territory of the third man and Don't Look Now. It's a beguiling thing in a freezing cold series of rooms.
The very beginning was an approach from a baggage company, actually, in America called Toomey. And they were launching with an Israeli designer a new body of work. They approached me and asked if I could think of a way of staging it. And I thought, well, what do you do with a bag? You travel. And really, that's how it came about, the notion of traveling and moving around. And so it's both the passage of people and the passage of bags. So we created a series of scenes, which happen over a number of countries. And a bag was passed in each of those countries.
We know that all good spies need a false bottom in their bags. We hope that this brand provides a false bottom, and now under these circumstances, post-passage.
In, funny enough, there are lots of hidden compartments in those bags, and it takes a long time if you buy one to discover all of them. So I think they were expecting some kind of interesting people to use them.
Thomas, we've walked through the heavy doors from the turbine hall with the restaurant. We're in a bit of a dank passage. There's some flickering neon and a photograph at a lopsided angle. It looks like we're in a place of decay.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it should resemble, actually. It's a derelict cinema, and that's the outside area of the cinema, if you so want, metaphorically speaking.
And there are three rooms. We're going to walk on through this spooky passageway and explore what we can see inside.
Let me guide you through then.
Down on some sort of formerly luxurious red carpet, and we really feel like we're in a cold cinema now. Maybe you can tell us a bit what this is, what this feels like in here.
Yeah, as I said before, the whole idea is that the cinema has been left, or you know, nobody has been here for quite some time, and in a way, maybe the movies just keeps running. And so, what we did, we have through screens running, and we also used photographs of a photographer from the 30s, John Maltby,
And so these are photographs of old Odeon cinemas,
correct, yeah.
From, I guess, before the war. They look like they're sort of Art Deco. They're rather exactly. The golden age of black and white and silent movies, looks like here.
They were taken all in the early 30s, so that's exactly what it is. And I think none of them exists anymore, so...
So we're taking a look at the sort of places we might be in now. And I like the attention to detail, Thomas, the fact that it is freezing in here. It really does feel like an abandoned cinema.
The weather today helps, yeah.
The film's running on a loop, and it seems to be... It's got a bit of a thriller idea to it as well, right?
Yes, that's what it is. So the idea was to shoot a thriller, and I maybe should explain that the film consists of some moving images, which we see now, we do, and then it gets into some still images. So the actual story is told by still images, and there is no dialogue, it's just the music you can hear. The idea was with the stills also, because there's no dialogue, there is the viewer makes up his or her own story to some extent. That's what we've been playing with a little bit, you know, that you're not quite sure what happens. So
to make a movie with stills like we're watching right now down in this cold cinema, how many shots did you take to choose the ones that you've shown us? Because there's quite a lot of editing, presumably, that's gone into this.
There's a thing, 129, 130, I'm not 100% sure, in our final still shots in the movie, plus those two moving bits, beginning and end. And interesting, some of the scenes, I've really only taken about 3 or 4 shots per scene. So very few of these are all taken on 5-4 on film. And there's some cafe scenes in Vienna, for instance, where there's 3 performers or 3 actors all in one scene. And some of them literally took 3 or 4 shots. So it's a very few shots. So the editing was, of course, important, but then it's almost like trying to get that specific instant in that scene that is the one that tells the story we want to tell.
We can hear from the spooky score behind us that there's obviously an attractive pull as well about this idea of Cold War. You're shooting in some of the great European cities. They look chilly and they look evocative of spies and of mystery. Is this a nice challenge for you as a photographer to rebuild this spooky European kind of heritage of spying?
We wanted to give some sort of feeling to the actual, I don't know, almost texture of that specific city. Like, I know Paris is like a courtesan, maybe. I mean, it's a little bit of cliches, but, and Venice, you know, Venice is Venice. Milan has a certain heaviness. I don't know if you know Milan, but you know, if you're in the center, it's all very partly fascist, but it's heavy, it's literally physically speaking. And also, of course, we shot January, February, March, so it was very cold. But that's what we tried to do. And we went to Trieste. So, and Vienna is all about these cafes and people eating there, you know, staying there for hours and hours. So we wanted the cities to have that sort of texture, to have a very, you know, different feel to the different cities.
Or maybe you can tell us where we are right now in the film, and then we'll sit down and take in some of the scenery.
Now we are at the Anzengruber Café in Vienna. Before we were just at the Greensteidl. And the main character, Julia, she's meeting Karl, and they keep having these meetings where they seem to come up with some sort of plot or something that she's supposed to do. So.
And there's a lot of... Hearteningly, there's a lot of schnapps and coffee being drunk in this movie, which we can heartily approve of.
That space is an amazing space. If you unify the floor in some way and you put 2 or 3 objects in it, the way in which you move into it, you go through a small door, and I always say to you, shut the door behind you. Your own imagination starts to fill the space, and you have to trust that. You know, if you are judicious about the way you select objects and things, then your viewer, your participant, does the rest of the work. You know, for example, in there, I'd never carpeted it before, but it's completely carpeted in a red carpet because that reminds you of old cinemas. And, you know, you unify the space immediately with that red carpet. So it draws the walls in.
How do you keep it surprising? I never know what I'm going to see when I walk into the Wapping Project.
I know, but I think you shouldn't know what you're going to see when you walk into the Wapping Project. I think it's got to be a place for dreams. Not necessarily my dreams, you know, they can be your dreams. But you should always be astonished and surprised. And that should be the reason you want to come back.
And that was Jules Wright and Thomas Zanon Larcher talking to us there from Passage, an immersive exhibition which opens this week at the Wapping Project in London's Docklands. Eerie, isn't it? Still to come in part two, we'll hear what to expect from this year's Art Stage Singapore. We'll hear how Berlin is celebrating Martin Scorsese ahead of the city's wonderful film festival. And we'll get a minute of sound from the Key West Literary Festival. Plenty to wrap your ears around, ain't there? So before we scoot off to Singapore, here's some more new music, this time from Ireland. Conor O'Brien performs under the name Villagers, and from the new album called Awayland, this is Nothing Arrived. I waited for something. That was Nothing Arrived, new music from Ireland, courtesy of Conor O'Brien, aka Villagers. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Pound. This week, one of Asia's newest international art fairs, Art Stage Singapore, will hold its third instalment, with more than 130 galleries expected to show works from some 600 artists. It's a pivotal year for the fledgling fair, which is trying to solidify its position in a crowded regional marketplace, particularly with the first edition of the much-hyped Art Basel Hong Kong coming in May. Monocle's Singapore correspondent Justin Bergman sat down with Art Stage director Lorenzo Rudolph to find out what to expect at the upcoming event.
An art fair and a successful art fair, on the one side, you cannot change every year the concept. With other words, we go on with our concept, which is a clear Asian identity. That will also happen this year. We want to have, like in the last two editions, around 75% Asian or Asia-Pacific galleries, exhibitors, and around 25 selected Westerners. On the other side, we always have also to develop an art fair, and that will also happen this year. We surely want to have some new galleries, some big new galleries, like, for example, Anthony Mayer coming from Los Angeles, like, for example, Timothy Taylor coming from London, like, for example, Continua, one of the probably most promising galleries worldwide coming from Italy, but also with branches in Paris and in Beijing, but also from Asia, big galleries like Koyanagi from Japan, like Kukshe, the biggest gallery in Korea, they all come down. With other words, I'm quite happy to see that it goes in a good direction. We surely also want to look this year, even more than in the past, to bring down and to organize entire trips for collectors, collector groups. We want to have entire groups from Australia coming, from Korea coming, from Japan, China, but even from the Orient, a big group is announced. From Spain, some of the biggest collectors want to come in a group here. So a fair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
Can you talk a little bit about Singapore's role in Asian art specifically and how you see Art Stage developing over the years?
I think Art Stage, in my eyes, is not only an art fair in Singapore, an international art fair, it's also part of an entire development of this city. I understand this fair and myself and ourselves as part of a cultural policy, of a cultural development. Singapore wants to become and is on the way to become a hub, a center for contemporary art in Southeast Asia and in Asia. And I think the fair is a flagship. But it cannot only happen during 4 or 5 days a year. It has to happen the entire year. We, from our side, we want to build up this fair and Singapore as its place, where once in the year, really the art world in the future even more comes to Singapore. Why? Because it's the only place where you really realize not only what is going on in the world and what is going on in Asia, but especially also what is going on in Southeast Asia. Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level. But I'm from Switzerland, and we are in the same situation, small, multicultural, and we are sitting in the middle of Europe, and I think that's what we have to play. And at the end, that's our identity, the multicultural. And I think in this direction, we have also to go regarding the art scene. And that's the big, I think, the big chance for Singapore, and we are part of it.
Talking about the art scene in Asia, generally, it's on the way up. Why are collectors so important to developing the art scene, as opposed to just galleries and museums that are driving the scenes in the West?
I think we have here in Asia, and especially in Southeast Asia, another history of contemporary art and other structures. As I said already before, we don't have a lot of museums. Entire Asia, for example, let's forget one Singapore, which is a very specific case, but quite all over Asia, all the major museums are private. That means all the major artworks are in private hands, not in public museums. More and more, we have also private people like these collectors opening their own private museums. That means bringing these works also to public. But we have to be clear, there is not a public structure supporting contemporary art, educating in contemporary art as we have in the West, especially in Europe. And that means it's a totally other approach. That means also for us, we have to work much, much closer with all these collectors that may be in the West, where we have to work much closer with public institutions. It's an ongoing process, which is normal. You have here a very, very young country, which is developing. It has also to do with generations, but I see it goes in the right direction.
That was Art Stage Singapore director Lorenzo Rudolph talking to Monocle's Singapore man, Justin Bergman there. And this is Culture on Monocle 24. Fancy a spot of Scorsese and then some chickens, cats and coconuts in Florida? Well, you'd better keep listening then.
In their perfectly turned out capital, Madrileños can choose between the best old school outfitters and some of the world's most exciting contemporary retailers. And Madrid Fashion Week is a chance to see the city at its well-dressed best. Rediscover Spain. Visit ineedspain.com.
Welcome back to the Culture Show. With only a few more weeks to go before the Berlin Film Festival, the city's already warming up its film aficionados with the first ever retrospective of one of the grand masters of 20th century movies, Martin Scorsese. The Italian-American director started his career at an early age. He was apparently only 11 when he drew his first storyboard. That same storyboard and some 600 more exhibits, ranging from family pictures, private letters, a music box, posters taken from his house, and of course, a lot of movie clips, are now on display in a strikingly personal exhibition at the city's Film Museum. Many of the artefacts are from his private archive, which he's opened up for the first time. Reporter Nikki Ertz walked through the show with one of the curators, Nils Warnecker, to learn a little bit more about the infamous director and his life.
Here, in terms of Bob De Niro as Max Cady in the remake we did of Cape Fear, he wanted to be covered with tattoos, and so we worked a long time on it. One interesting thing that you notice here is that on the picture on his right arm is a panther. That's a real tattoo. And the first time, he never showed it in films. He doesn't usually show it in films, but he had it shown in Mean Streets also. And I see he's got a broken heart there for Loretta. Yeah.
Martin Scorsese revealing Robert De Niro's true tattoo is just one of the discoveries to be made at the world's first retrospective of the master's body of work. The show at the Berlin Film Museum brings together more than 600 pieces from Scorsese's personal archives and offers a unique insight in the director's development, which started at an early age. Curator Nils Warnecker explains.
This is the storyboard Martin Scorsese has drawn in 1953 when he was 11 years old. He was, of course, very impressed and influenced by films he saw on television and in the cinema, and thinking of all these huge, big Italian monumental films about the Roman times, and he loved these.
The young Martin Scorsese had asthma and often had to stay home. He spent his time watching movies or sitting in the window of his parents' apartment in Little Italy, New York, observing people passing by.
So he was sitting there in the window and he was watching. That's where everything started. He was watching a lot. And he registered everything. And he reflected about everything. And he started to understand how the world functions in a way by watching and by looking at every detail. And that's what you can see in these early storyboards also, that he is very aware of details, and that he also already had a feeling for, let's say, focusing on details or showing a panorama shot or something. So that evolved very, very early.
Also on display are lots of family pictures, arranged just as they were in the living room of his parents. Scorsese's Italian background unmistakably influenced him, and he spent a lot of time trying to understand his roots. He filmed hours of him talking to his parents, sitting at their kitchen table. That table, as well as a film he made about them, are on view here.
Lovey-dovey, sort of, you know. They say as you get older, your love grows stronger. So for some reason, it is getting a little stronger, you know. Right, Daddy? He's bashful.
Yeah, I know.
And there's more. Correspondence, film scripts, original costumes, and one of Scorsese's personal music boxes with records from the Marvelettes and Chuck Berry, as well as film posters that still decorate Scorsese's home, but were taken down to bring to Berlin.
Two beautiful big ones, both from films of Federico Fellini, which is one of his heroes, actually, and one is 8.5 for Scorsese, the most important and the best film shot about filmmaking ever. And Livitelloni here, which is the French, of course. Livitelloni is the original title in Italian, which is a French poster from that time, is about five guys, young guys in Italy in the early 50s. And when he saw that film, he was reminded of himself, the young guy in Little Italy in this Italian community in New York. And so his early films started in the late 60s with Who's That Knocking at My Door? And of course then 73, Mean Streets.
I borrow money from you because you're the only jerk off around here that I can borrow money from without paying back, right? Right? Because you know that's what you are. That's what I think of you, a jerk off. You're smiling like because you're a jerk off. You're a fucking jerk off. I'll tell you something else, Mikey. I fuck you right where you breathe, because I don't give two shits about you or nobody else.
These are the stories about young men living in Little Italy and being in maybe or caught in the conflict between family and religion, religious values, and the mafia, of course.
And then there's this remarkable object, straight from the Harry Ransom Center, Austin, Texas.
A shirt from Cape Fear, which is the only remake Scorsese ever did. It's based on the film Cape Fear from 1961, from Lee Thompson, and is also, from talking about the style of the film, very influenced by Alfred Hitchcock, who was one of the other heroes of Martin Scorsese. And this shirt, Robert De Niro wears in the film, and he is, I mean, he's the bad guy in the film, of course he's the bad guy in the film, but the other guy tries to defend himself and his family, and so he's beaten up by three really bad guys, and he's injured very, very heavily, and this shirt is kept in Austin, and it's really strange, the blood still looks fresh.
Oh, Max! Counselor! Is that you? Counselor! I'm out, come out, wherever you are.
He is a little bit unhappy, actually, that the usual association with his films and his persona is violence and blood. I mean, don't understand me wrong. There is violence and blood in some of his films, and a lot of it. He never turns the camera away, never ever, because he says, when there's violence, and I will show it. But when you take all these films, more than 30 to the present day, there is a minority of films that show this violence, and a majority of films that don't show violence at all. It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
The exhibition's personal insight into the life and works of Martin Scorsese has so far gone down well with Berlin's critics. It will travel to Milan, Italy, and Ghent, Belgium later this year, and maybe, just maybe, New York after that. But for now, it's in Berlin, at the city's Film Museum, until the 12th of May. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Niki Arts.
That's nearly it, folks. A lot of art this week, but a global lot at that. So before we go, it's time to change the tone a bit and take a trip down a long, long highway, all the way down to Key West. It's a place that's historically played host to many a famous writer, and they've just held their 31st annual Key West Literary Seminar. We'll be getting a report on the event in a couple of shows' time, but here's a little taster of some of the wonderful sounds that this part of the world has to offer.
We are in Key West, Florida. This is the only cabaret in Key West.
Naked ladies upstairs wearing nothing but a smile.
We have shows 7 days a week, head-to-toe outfit changes, group numbers, the full bit.
Sound I love, can't get enough of.
Tropical. And that really is it, folks. Next week, we'll hear what it's like to try and get your film noticed at Sundance, and we'll meet the colourful Queen of Versailles, no less. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilbao, and Holly Fisher whipped us up into a frenzy and put us back in place again like a beautifully arranged sonic jigsaw. Time for one final song this week. This is from Yola Tengo's new album. It's called Fade. The track is Well You Better. Thanks for tuning in. But it's not, it's not